The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 26, 2019. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I really don't have any talk planned this morning. Again, I thought maybe if you have some questions, we can just do a little Q&A here. So if there's anything you might want to discuss regarding our teachings here that we have, or something you've heard me say, or Norm, or Steve, or anything that you've come upon in your readings or anything of that sort, something that you've long pondered about this practice in this way that you'd like some clarification on, anything at all. Yeah, David.
Linda, just listened to the Wednesday night talk that I gave a month or so ago. So she was talking to me about that downstairs just now. And she said that it seems like the general tenor of the teachings by the teachers here is impersonal, as opposed to some of the Wednesday night talks given by students, which are often more personal. And she was wondering why that was.
Well, I don't know if that's the case or not, but it certainly is a major concern for us, you know, our own personal issues and understandings and things of this sort. So very often we're kind of occupied with that and looking at things from our own personal point of view, or perhaps how we've worked out certain kinds of problems or things like this. And that's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But these teachings in this way that we have, it's kind of strange in two different ways, which probably tends to run counter to how we normally might operate or think or practice or, you know, live, where the impersonal, what we might think of as the impersonal is very personal, and the other way around, things that we might think that are personal, we don't give that much attention to. So it could seem kind of flipped. Like just one example. Well, I could probably give several examples, but maybe see if I can come up with one for going in each direction. But say, when it comes to matters of morality or just living an upright life or something of this sort, very often our kind of thinking or the kind of training or practice or teaching that we receive in regards to this is applied in kind of personal ways, you know, about your personal behavior or what it is that you should do or think or embrace or hold. So we might have moral teachings, not just necessarily in religions or something like that, which easily will come out in the form of some kind of dictum or rule of behavior or something like this. But if we look carefully at how we teach and what we point to here, we don't have anything like that at all. But oftentimes people, because we're used to hearing a teaching like that, coming, you know, from an apparent religious perspective, we might receive it in that way and hear it in that way. And so very often we will hear these teachings in a way that's backwards from what's actually being offered and shown and set out there. So we might take these things in kind of a personal way. But when we look very carefully, say like at the precepts, which we recite here, you know, about every 7 weeks or so, you know, follow the way, it does not kill, is the first one. You can say, well, that seems kind of impersonal. You know, follow the way, does not kill. Yeah, if that were a commandment directed at it, thou shalt not kill, or you should not. But we don't do that. We just simply don't do that. We just point out that this is about awakening and enlightenment. You want to live in a way that kind of matches reality and how it unfolds and how we can live in a peaceful and harmonious way, that you're going to keep making this about you in some way. You're going to be disturbed and perplexed and troubled endlessly about this. Of course, that's our usual way, because I want to know about me, or how should I behave, or what should I do, as opposed to just looking at this in a very general and broad way. So just pointing out that one who's living out of this practice is with a concern for just living out of awakeness, they don't kill, we can say. Of course, then we look at the question of what does that mean, killing. Exactly. That's kind of the approach we'll take there. On the other hand, when we are interpreting everything or even these teachings and what it means to me and how I've worked this out, or then the preoccupation, becomes more me-oriented and focused on that. And this, again, is kind of our normal way. This is how we think of things during the day, or you know, it's always got me in the picture. And so we'll speak to that. And when we hear other kinds of people expressing things and how they've worked this out or what it means to them, and it's kind of a personal story that they might offer in some way, we will gravitate toward that, you know, and just it becomes kind of meaning. We want to hear those kinds of things. And we like hearing stories about people. And even if it isn't somebody saying something about their own personal life and what this did for them or whatever, we like to engage in stories, you know, somebody might be saying about some other individuals, other people. This easily takes us, it captivates us, it grabs us. It sounds interesting, and there's something in there that I can work with and make use of, but it's also something by which you form judgments of others and any number of things here that might not really necessarily have much to do with the truth of our lives and what we're living out here together, drawing the distinctions so sharply that we lose sight of what it is that, in a general way, we're all facing and dealing with in kind of a non-personal way. Other kinds of things, too, that I could point out about this, and I've mentioned this from time to time, though I know I haven't talked about this recently. But I think of people, like just some famous examples of people that, so we all know the example here. But you can look at somebody like, say, a Martin Luther King or a Mohandas Gandhi, and people like this who are living in a way, at least what comes out through their teachings and their, ostensibly their practice, I guess, is that here you have people who were very much moved, forming pretty much everything they do in their lives, their careers, whatever. Everything is wrapped up in how they're responding to the pains and the sufferings of the world. But for people like this, I think we can safely say, at least if you're going to have any effects in this area, it is all quite impersonal. So it isn't your personal suffering, say of a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King or whatever. It's not a personal. You're responding to the pains and the cries of the world. This is what you feel. And you can respond to that and live out of that. That you're not making it your own, or how much this hurts me, it pains me to see this or hear this or whatever. The moment we start to move in that direction, we lose sight of the full situation that we're in. This is why, too, I point out from time to time that to the Buddhas, you know, do you want to go right to the, what can I say, the extreme of this, those who are fully awake. What it is that makes one awake, it's not that it makes you awake, this is what it is. Buddhas are those who do not lose sight of the whole. And to the extent that they really don't have much sight on themselves personally at all. And this is the release from the suffering and the pain, the confusion, you know, all of the things that can vex us and trouble us and disturb us and bring sorrow into our lives, all of that. They're not experiencing this, at least not in the way that we might otherwise experience this, because we are concerned about me and how I might react to this and what should I do here. Our concerns are tightly confined in that way. We remain caught in the very thing that we would like to resolve here. I don't want to experience, but that's how we perpetuate it. those who break out of this and are seeing this sorrowful situation that human beings continuously put themselves in are free to act and to teach and to point out things in a way that might be helpful. But there's nothing personal in it. To the extent that there is, and it's not like that's bad or whatever, but we can start to get to a point where we become sensitive to this. And to the extent that the preoccupation has, you know, is kind of focused on me, now there's a great deal of suffering there and frustration and lack of understanding, like really not understanding what this situation is, what can we do about it. And it can also look frightening or troubling in all sorts of ways. To the extent that we just, it isn't like we forget ourselves or throw ourselves away or anything. It's just simply not where we keep ourselves occupied with that. And we're looking at the situation here in the world and how it's unfolding here in the world. And the real, what can I say? I have several words that come to mind. They're all not the words I want. But the release, maybe I can say, from the kinds of things that otherwise really deeply trouble us and vex us and seem to continue on. These things quiet down, settle down, and even drop away to the extent that we lose ourselves and our concern is here with the life of the world, which is truly what our life is. It is the life of the world. To the extent that we see it and react to it out of that way and occupy ourselves with it from that perspective. The personal suffering that we otherwise are troubled with and that we keep exacerbating by constantly looking at the personal side of things and fascinated by that, hearing from someone else and their personal thing here, we keep ourselves locked in that kind of trouble and that frustration, that pain, that sorrow, without ever resolving it. And yet all the while we think that this is really what I need to do and this is how I need to learn. No, it really isn't. See if you can just kind of let that go. You're always going to be interacting with others and in the world where there are details and different things that we need to take care of and be mindful of. And all that's, yeah, sure, that's a given. But you don't need to occupy yourself from your point of view, your thinking about this or what can I do to relieve my pain, that sort of thing. We throw it out into our concern for the pains of the world. Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion. It's kind of an image that we have. I don't go looking for some particular person there who's Avalokiteshvara. But this is from the perspective of one who's living out of compassion, one who's personifying compassion. And she's often described as the hearer of the cries of the world. This is where the concern is. In forgetting the self, the personal self, and living out of that and seeing this and knowing this, that this is, you know, the sorrow that you feel. It's not yours. It is that of the world. And now we can address it in that way, but not with some kind of intention or mission that I got to bring to an end, this or that. Don't get too occupied with the specifics about things. But that's kind of what's in these teachings, is to direct our attention to this, to really just to get outside of ourselves a little bit. And there we can find some peace and some profound understanding and maybe also live in a way that might be effective in terms of helping others out of the confusion that otherwise so easily envelops all of us. So I don't know, did I answer that or... But, yeah.
You mentioned Gandhi. One of the most moving and personal teachings that I ever heard from him was during the time of partition, where there was great chaos between the Hindus and the followers of Islam. And a Hindu man came to him and said that he had personally bashed the head of a Islamic kid against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And Gandhi said, "What you must do is go find an Islamic orphan and raise him as your son."
Mm-hmm.
That was a very personal.
Yes, but he said also to raise him as a Muslim, not as a Hindu.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's kind of the critical point, I think, of that little story.
Yeah.
And can you see how that throws it open into the whole? You're not confined to the, this is Hindu way, we're going to show this boy, straighten him out and show him the Hindu way, which is better than that Islamic way.
But it's still very personal.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying, too, that we're always, there's always going to be the personal kinds of things that come up. It isn't like we ignore this or run away from it, but that's not the place to occupy yourself. The place to remain is to always be, to the extent you can. This would be a Buddha who never loses sight of the whole. That's why Gandhi, he was very close to that point where he could see that. And so in saying, yeah, and here's a personal, intimate situation between several people, okay. And now, but looking at this, don't lose sight of the whole. See it from that perspective. And that's why he was able to offer really the thing that goes to the heart of that particular issue. Take a boy now who is Muslim and raise him as your own son, but raise him as a Muslim. And that opens up everything. For that boy, it will open up all kinds of things. Being raised in a Hindu family, but he's being raised in this way, it'll open up the family, the father, and all of this. It might start affecting other people in the community. This is the effect that these things have. To the extent that we will constantly see it from our own personal perspective, very difficult to find anything like this at all. And yet that is where we need to, just not lose sight of it. It isn't like we have to actively act out of any particular thing here. That's where we'll always go. And I'm not going to take this teaching or what it is I'm trying to point out now or what Gandhi did and to carry it into something like that. But that's because we want something kind of specific here. But this is pretty broad and open. Just raise him as a Muslim. Well, of course, then we want, what exactly would that involve? Do you mean I should, we'll start to, again, we want to get it narrow. Find out what the heart of what this is. Can you do this? This boy was born into a Muslim family. And he's orphaned because of all the mayhem that's going on around him. Now take care of this boy as though he were your own son. But he's Muslim, so. So there's nothing, no particular directive about that, just in this very general way. And so once again, our teachings, they're very general. They're not specific. And they're not personal. And yes, well, I don't want to repeat for the third time now, because in my original remarks, I was pointing out how, yes, we're always in what could appear a personal. Here I am, and I'm interacting with others. And there's all kinds of things that that are personal about this. And that will just remain, it will continue that way. But what I'm saying is you don't need to put your mind there and focus on those things and try to work it out by maneuvering all these particular details. That's where we can let go and look at it as in a very general way. And now, spontaneously in the moment, what needs to be done here and there without losing sight of the whole? This is what I'm saying. I'm not saying forget the personal. Now, that's just always there. It's a given. Can't really step away from that. But don't let that then become the focus of what it is you're going to do or how to understand the situation. The way to really understand this way, this whole situation in a way that releases, can have at least a chance to release us from the kind of pain, suffering, dukkha, and misery, and confusion, and hatred, and all this that otherwise can easily take us away, is to not lose sight of the whole. This is what I'm saying. But yeah, within this, though, the personal interactions, of course, these are going on. So, like I said, you can't get rid of that. But again, don't now make those particular details the focus. Give them a general view. You're still going to have to feed the boy. There's going to be specific things that will come up now and all these kinds of things. Well, yeah, but then take care of them as they come up. Anticipate, needs and things like this and take care of them. It's pretty simple. And it's easier, actually. If you can really let go of yourself and just do this, and you also, your heart might open up to those people of a different sort, a different religion, Muslim or Hindu or whatever they might be. And maybe we can begin to live in the way that Rodney King, you remember when he said that thing that has become a kind of a cliche almost now, but you know, can't we all get along? Yeah, well, the way that we can, if we all just forget ourselves and realize that, you know, what we have in common is so much more than the things that divide us. And yet we will occupy ourselves with the things that divide us, the particulars. This is all I'm saying here. And within those particulars, how there's things from the personal angle and all of this. You know. Again, we can't kill that. We can't stop it. It's always going to be there. So we don't need to worry about that. Somebody, it'll be there. But how do we deal? Well, the best way is just kind of see if you can keep your mind on the actual world that we're creating here and living out of. That's all. Anything else?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes.
So I think the teaching is from the Dhammapada, but I'm not sure. And the teaching is, without the unborn, the ungrown, and the unconditioned, there would be no release for the born, the grown, and the conditioned. And it seems to me that those are thoroughly interdependent.
Oh, yeah.
Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You could just as easily say, without the born, the grown, and the conditioned, there would be no awareness of the unborn. The unborn.
Absolutely.
And the unconditioned.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Say more if you want, or something else.
It's not from the Dhammapada, I don't think, but it's from one of the Nikayas, I think. Is that what you said? I really don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. I could look it up for you,
okay.
but off the top of my head, I can't tell you. Well, you can find it in Ruhula, what the Buddha taught,
okay.
and he'll have the source for it.
Yeah.
Because that's what I would have done if you wanted me to. Okay. That's where I'd look first anyway. But I couldn't really tell you off the top of my head. But I could say, too, this is why we also have teachings just kind of related to it. I think what you said there, that's it. You break to the point and you got it. But just to maybe give one other example, we talk about how, and I use this last, I don't know, which talk recently in the Nagarjuna series, the last or the second to the last talk, I can't remember. But when I talked about Nirvana, there's a chapter on Nirvana.
Yes.
And right, Nirvana and Samsara. You know,
yes.
And we'll see when we're looking at the particulars, and we're looking at differences, and now the focus is, well, here's Samsara, which is full of the particulars and
yes.
all of that. And here's Nirvana, which we can't even really get hold of in any way whatsoever. But then we have this teaching. It says even these things, they look so starkly opposite from each other and different from each other. You know, we have this teaching that says that these are one. These are not two. Actually, maybe to say they're one is maybe going too far, but really the salient thing to be aware of here is these are not two. Even though they certainly, the moment we say something, they look like two. You know, and so and one of the things that Nagarjuna points out there, he didn't, not quite so directly, but I try to help you see that this is really what he's saying. That if you want to see Nirvana, because maybe Nirvana seems like some mysterious thing, but it seems like probably a good thing, maybe we might have that impression. It's quiet and peaceful, all of that. But what exactly is Nirvana? Well, again, it isn't an object. It isn't something we can grasp. But it is just this. And what is this? Well, it's what we see, what we experience, what we feel and taste and all of this. What is that exactly? Well, this is Samsara. If you want to see Nirvana, you're looking at Samsara, the world of coming and going, you know, the world of birth and death and pain and suffering and confusion, and well, also of elation and joy and happiness, all of that as well, which is all tumbling together. And then where we start to occupy ourselves with the details, trying to get the good stuff over here where I am and keep that other stuff, here we are. But if we can see this thing in wholeness and in totality, we see this is the peaceful right here. All of this. You won't find it in the details. I think another thing we looked at there out of Nagarjuna, if I remember right, we pointed out that in the details are always, it's going to be kind of kind of murky, you know. It will seem like, when we're looking at the whole, that this seems kind of murky because we can't find the details. But understanding is there. When we start getting into the details and we want to sharpen those up, the distinctions and all of that, well, yeah, now, that might now start to seem kind of very clear and distinct in that. But actually, the overall picture here is not clear at all. So once again, as I mentioned at the very start when I first was talking, you know, we easily flip these things over. You know, well, in our minds, they're already kind of flipped over and we're occupied with that. We need to realize that we're looking at it all kind of backwards and upside down. But in that way then, so nirvana and samsara, they're not, can't really say they're two. You can't really say they're one though either. So even though we do have a teaching that says nirvana and samsara are one, that may be just kind of helpful to get us to at least start to drop the idea that they're distinctly different. But that's also going to an extreme. We're going a little too far with that because we can't really say that they're one. Can't say that they're two. So what are they? Do you need to answer anything? We can see how this is. If you say something, that's not it. You can never say, but we can see. It's not one, it's not two. Why do we have to be so driven to say it's one or the other?
Would you say, is it fair to say that as soon as you try to say something about it, you get confused?
Yeah.
About it?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very confusing when you try to put it into words.
Yeah, and the confusion is there right from the start when you think that you can or that you have to do it, that it, you know, I won't know this unless I can do that. No, the opposite is true. Drop it. You can see what's going on here. It's not one, it's not two. You know, the one and the many, which is it? You know, you can't say it's either one. You can also see directly that this isn't nothing. Now we're moving into Nagarjuna's tetralemma. You know, so it's not this, it's not that, it's not both, and it's not neither. This can all be seen. But you try to say something about that, it's amazing that Nagarjuna was even able to say that much, you know, without really totally violating it. But it does leave us then kind of, huh? And this is how, like, maybe the impersonal kind of talking that we have here might make us feel that way. But you should come back to this. Come back to it and come back to it. It struck me that way too with my teacher for a long time. I could feel something from what he was saying, but I couldn't really quite see what he was saying. Because what he was saying, for the most part, the stuff that was worth me finally waking up to, wasn't stuff that I could get hold of or form into an idea. But I started to realize, I can see this. And that's what this is available to us all. But it will be kind of impersonal, you know, all of this kind of. So we can look for our deep desire to grasp. And we don't need to do that. All the things that we want to get from grasping, I want to get the idea, I want to get this right. And what are you, if you stop and look, you're frustrated, if you're a little angry, you're disgusted with this, I'm going to go on to something else, where you just continue in the same way and no resolution there. At some point we need to just stop. Take a look at this. Then we'll have a heart that's open to raise the Muslim boy as a Muslim. And also we would have the heart that would never smash another kid's head against the wall or something like that. You know, the peaceful will come out of that, out of the seeing it in terms of the wholeness and never being tossed over to one side or the other, where we become angry and start to act in a mirror way of all those bad people over there, without ever reflecting on. You know, we look kind of the same in the way that we're carrying on. So once again, it's in these places where we are far more alike than we are different. And yet, we'll easily go into the splintered world and try to straighten it out there, which cannot be done. So. But thank you for that observation, Mary. It was good. But what you said, in a nutshell, you had it right there. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Anything else?
Yeah. You know, this whole discussion, it seems to me like an excellent pointer for a question that was asked a couple of weeks ago about was think not thinking.
Mm-hmm.
This is think not thinking.
Yes, yeah, right.
And so it's a great example of how what Dogen's pointing at, how that's in our life, that's an answer in a way. I mean, I know it's not an answer, but I think this whole discussion is an excellent pointer for that.
Yes, thank you. That's a good point. Yeah. And really, what we're discussing here is pretty basic. It's getting right down to kind of the heart of the issue. Where we just get it, we're off.
That's one of the first things that I went to when I started coming here. I'm like, what the heck is that?
Yeah.
How do you live like that? So, you know, sitting for a while, that's what you have to do, and then, or what you want to do, what you've been called to do, and then discussions like this, questions like this. That's thinking.
Exactly.
Thinking.
Yeah.
It's the personal, not personal. I remember in, I think it's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Suzuki talks about being like a stone, and I just felt so offended by that teaching because I'm such an emotional person.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, well, what the heck? But I get it now. Because it's there too. You're not throwing anything away.
Absolutely not.
You know, but at the same time, you need to have that steadiness. You know, that quiet.
Yes.
And then the think not thinking.
That makes a lot of sense.
Right there.
And so as for the emotional stuff, you know, if we think that we have to, or we want to spend time there and explore all of that, and that's what we're doing is we're blocking it all out, and maybe we get ideas like we need to stifle the emotions or block it out or become stoic and just sit there. And that's not what this is at all. This is about completely feeling it, to feel the feelings thoroughly through and through. So you burn them up in this very moment, completely consume this. This is the burning of your life in each moment. So it's not to block any of this or to stifle it or to shut it down or to say, ish, bad, throw it away. But this is about really in the midst of all of this to sit down and see it, to feel it, to know it, to realize it. But to the extent that our mind then can open up into wholeness, we can live with this, and even then to know how to act, even in those places where we don't know how to act. But just realizing that if we need to act, then we can act, and if not, we don't need to. But still remain awake, because in the next moment, something might show itself that we need to respond to or whatever. So it's think not thinking. That's another way of putting it. That was a good observation. Thank you. Anything else? Yes?
I don't think this is really a question that can have an answer, I suspect, that you can just give now, but I find myself thinking about how much the practice of Buddhism and Zen has changed since Katagiri came to the U.S. And I find myself really curious about, for example, if you went back to Japan today, you know, what would your experience be like, and what would you see? What would you notice as different from what you experienced then?
Well, I don't know. I haven't been back. That was over 30 years ago. But and Japan at that time was kind of going through some major changes culturally. I was born right at the end of World War II. I was born in 1945. And I noticed when I was in Japan 35 years ago or so, something like that, 36 years ago, the people who are about my age, maybe just a little bit younger than me, were born after the war. Well, even my age they would have been, but they still would have been kind of affected by the difficulties that Japan was faced with right after the war. But shortly after that, so people that were just slightly younger than me were in many ways quite different from their parents, who were far more traditional. They were also bigger, you know, because they had better nutrition now. After a few years after the war, they, you know, like Katagiri Roshi was very small, you know. But because he's born at a time when nutrition and that sort of thing wasn't quite so available to the population at large. And anyway, and also the customs that they did, you know, how they would sit. They would sit on the floor, and you know, and they were used to things like that. I remember one night, evening, with Kagiroshi in his village where he was ostensibly the teacher there in the village, though he was here in the States. But they were kind of wining and dining us and stuff like that. Well, without wine, but dining us anyway. And the gentleman, I think he was maybe the mayor of the town there or whatever, who had us over, he his mother came in and sat down after the dinner and everything. We all sat on, in this large room of the house, sitting on the floor. And this lady, who was probably about my mother's age or maybe a little older, she was in her 80s than this lady, I think, but she came walking in. Well, my mother would have been younger than that at that point, but even so, I couldn't imagine my mother walking in like this lady did and just sat down, just folded up and sat down in a kneeling posture on the floor and remaining that way for the next 3 hours as we were discussing things. And then when it was time to break up, she just stood up and walked out of the room. And I'm trying to imagine my mother, you know, being able to do that. Which is, but what was interesting, though, is that while I was in Japan, the younger people, like, as I said, who were younger than me and also taller than their parents, also, like me, would maybe want to sit in a chair. You go to a restaurant or whatever, the older people would be sitting at low tables on the floor. Often they would have arrangements where other, maybe a catering now to Western people or tourists or whatever, where they, like in the big cities like Tokyo or something, and they'd be sitting, they would prefer not to sit on the floor. And I remember too, they're talking with some young people, and they were kind of admiring, things like blue jeans and that, and so their dress, everything was really changing and kind of westernizing. So that was what I was faced with, what I was seeing when I got to Japan. And now that has progressed on. It was like things were really starting to turn over at that time in Japan. But right now I have no idea how that has carried on, but I can imagine it might have only, changed even more so, where they become in some ways more westernized. Though at the same time, there are also kind of traditions that were there that look like they're not going to change much. And why should they? There's a lot of beautiful things there in Japan and in their traditional ways and that sort of thing. But we are living in a time now where there's so much travel and interaction between cultures and things like this, that there's a lot of kind of blending going on, but also maybe learning from various cultures and things. Now, I don't know if I'm really answering your question.
I think part of me wonders if there's more traditional Japanese sort of than practiced in the United States than there is in Japan.
Yes, in Japan, the lay people there, for the most part, they don't practice.
Right.
There some do, very few, though. They're the...
farming out to the monks, right? Basically the monks were supposed to be the ones meditating.
Well, that wasn't even going on.
That wasn't even going on?
No.
Okay.
Very little of it. That's quite different. There were teachers like Katagiri Roshi and Suzuki Roshi who had come to the West and to the United States and Europe and other places who very much wanted to, and I knew some teachers over there in Japan who wanted to come over here for the very reason that they felt that here in the West, there was a, there'd be more of a spirit among the lay people to really take up the practice and to do it and to carry it out. Because in Japan, very few people would do that. And even among the monks who were training there, they were just getting their training so they can get their certification so they could run a temple somewhere, but who themselves were not engaged in like daily practice. As I saw with Katagiri Roshi, and that's what I followed his way, inspiration for me and for Norm, and so we're always here. But you, it's so easy to just be taken from this and distracted from this, and to not follow through. And so even here in the United States, the same sort of thing, I think, is unfolding, kind of, in some ways. And like Katagiri said, it's probably going to take 300 years for Zen to really get to America and have its own expression here in America. But it's probably going to take on similar kinds of characteristics like that. And I think it's mainly because, you know, as human beings, like I said, we're more alike than not. And so I can see how practice here might take on, you know, kind of a similar kind of appearance. And less emphasis on the daily sitting and the practice, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then maybe even focused on other things altogether, or not really seeking out the subtle understandings of these teachings and what these teachings are pointing to. That might be difficult or even kind of boring, or, you know, because we're looking for something I can grasp and use and put on like a badge or a certificate or an identity or something like that. We're looking for these superficial kinds of things. But there is something in this practice and in this way that will, if we could just really stay with it and look at it, take us into the subtle depths of human mind, where we can wake up to the reality of our lives and live out of that. Direct out of wholeness. But that's something for each of us. And this is where it gets personal now in our way. Like I said, it's kind of flipped from how we normally are. But this is for your personal effort, you know. This is what you need to not lose sight of, what you need to do. If you really want to wake up to this in terms of the wholeness and the totality, you've got to pay attention to how you're living this out day to day. It's very important. To do this without judgment of yourself or of others, or, you know, but just, do we want to live out of awareness or not? I mean, if we do, well, then at some point, sit down, settle your mind, quiet down. You don't have to stay that way, because you got to get up and go to work and different things need to be done. But even there, in those situations, don't lose sight of your mind and where you are. But that's what this practice really is. Any of us can do it. You can do this as a lay person. You don't have to become a priest or something like that. But it is a matter of just, you know, carrying out this practice. It make every effort to live out of awareness and maybe with less emphasis on your personal stuff. And to be honest, I really don't know what my personal stuff is anymore. I just don't pay much attention to it. If I'm at a restaurant, I'll choose the kind of dish I want to eat. Okay, that'll be my personal thing. But most of the rest of the time, you know, what's showing up here with Dharma Field here too? My personal preference didn't really come into much of anything here at all. I hope not at all, but who can say? But I don't think so. I was, and I still am, I'm looking at what will be helpful for us overall. In terms of, you know, seeing what these teachings are pointing out, learning to settle down and practice and quiet our minds and pay some attention to this, because this stuff is very subtle and easily missed, easily misinterpreted. So that's always really been the fault. And this is really what I want to do. You know, I'm a happy man. There isn't anything I feel like I'm lacking that I need to go get or something like that. But the happiness is in just, let's do our best here, just to create a place where maybe we can all learn to, you know, settle down, find our minds, and become less insane, all of that. Yeah. Anything else?
So on Wednesday, we recited the formal submission. And the formal submission says, all the karma ever created by me since of old, through greed, anger, and self-delusion, which has no beginning, born of my body, speech, and thought, I now make full open admission of it. Can you say something about that, which has no beginning?
Yeah. Well, maybe we could say it has no discernible beginning. And that's one thing that Nagarjuna points out, because we're talking about beginnings and ends, and we're talking about time, what appears to be unfolding in time. And so there's a before, you know, and now there's a during, and then there's an after, and things like this, or there's a past and a present and a future. So things are, we'll, and this is our conscious life gives this appearance that things are strung out in just this way. And if there is something formed within this experience, as there will be just through consciousness, as, you know, so we see this and that and the next thing, these are the splintered things that we tend to occupy ourselves with now, losing sight of the whole. And it's not like these are bad or anything, the splintered things, but that's just not everything, you know, so don't lose sight of the whole. But once we have these distinctions and things that are being made and appearing to change and all of this constantly, and there is this sense of time, all of this, if you look very carefully, a couple of things, you can see that all these things are actually empty of any kind of substantia. That's right there on the surface. That can be seen, but we'll miss it because these things are very compelling, the distinctions of various kinds. And they're real enough. There's not like they're nothing or something like that to be ignored. But they don't carry the weight or substance that we otherwise think. But if you look carefully at these things, then you can see from that that there, for this to appear here at all, there has to be something. It's part of the appearance of it right now in this moment. It's what we can call the past. And it could be the immediate past or the remote past, but there's a past there. Just from something, and not necessarily a physical thing, but a thought or a feeling, there's a past to it. And it would seem, and this is what Nagarjuna helps us with, it would seem then that there's some kind of boundary there that's marking that past from what, this moment, or maybe from some other moments in the past. So there seems to be these boundaries like this. But it seems like we can trace any one of these things back to a point where that's it. That's where it started. That's where it was, you know, that's birth. That's, you know, something is made. No, if you look very carefully, even in the formation of this cup, let alone birth, you know, I remember even as a kid, I used to kind of wonder, I guess my mother told me, was it on my birth certificate or something? And I was an older kid. I mean, I wasn't a little kid, but I noted that it had the exact moment on the clock. You know, I was born at 2:45 in the afternoon, which I guess is kind of an unusual time, but most births are at other times of the day, I think. But I was born at 2:45 in the afternoon. So I got to thinking about that. Okay, so at 2:44, I wasn't born yet. At 2:46, I was here. And what about 10 seconds after 2:44? I mean, you know, and doesn't that take a little while to actually come out of the womb and, you know, and then take a first breath? I mean, that isn't like instantly here you are. So, but they're marking it down to the minute. But when exactly are we born? When exactly does that take place? But I was going to say, even in the making of this cup, is there an instant? And you will never find that. And because the reality of it is, you know, these markings, these distinctions that I was pointing out there, and that Nagarjuna speaks of, these are conceptual constructs. And they're handy and useful, and it makes, you know, it's handy to say, well, okay, I was born at 2:45 in the afternoon. Okay, that's handy. But let's not take hold of this like this is the truth. And then what exactly was born at that time? And if I say I, what, this guy sitting here now, you know, 73 years ago was, you know, and at that moment on that particular day, I mean, but we'll talk like this is Jeff, this is how it is, you know. But really, we can see that it's not exactly like that. Well, then how is it exactly? Like you're never going to pin that down. So there's no discernible limit. So when we say from the beginning, what does it say? Which has no beginning. Yeah, so we don't really find true beginnings or ends. There appears to be beginnings and ends in the world of appearances, of things that appear to be coming and going. But in reality, can't really say that that's the case.
It sounds very personal, but at the beginning it says, all the karma ever created by me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sounds very personal.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And once again, this is a place where now you can look at yourself in this way, because what it is, in the formless admission, we're just saying, before we take the precepts or certain things that we might do, we will recite the formless admission. And it's formless. formless, meaning that there isn't any particular thing that is you, nor are you saying this to any particular form thing out there, Buddha or God or what. No particular form thing. That's why it's called formless. And also, you're also formless as well. Nevertheless, there is, for most of us, we're caught up with self. We're tied in here. We have this sense of self. And out of this sense of self, we have acted and we've spoken and acted in ways that, well, they're creating karma. What? Well, this is out of willed action, willed intention, you know, and thought and this sort of thing. And out of which, you know, the Buddhas point out, you know, that this is tied to dukkha, to sorrow, to pain and suffering. And what's happening in the formless admission, we're just admitting, have I, this formed thing here, this illusory formed thing here, out of its confusion of seeing a self here, myself here, and have I acted, have I spoken, have I carried on in some ways that have created karma or the kinds of entanglements and sufferings and things that come from willed action. And so all we're doing is admitting this. You know, yes, I have.
It's not very personal. Again, when you say, all the karma ever created on me since of old, through greed, anger, and self-delusion, which has no beginning, and it's totally impersonal.
Yes, right.
Totally impersonal.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Okay. And mm-hmm. There's a universality to it.
Mm-hmm, yes.
It's like explaining to me.
Right. By the time you get to the end of it, it's,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But it's in doing that, if we're really looking carefully at what we've just recited here, so we're kind of dropping the personal stuff. You know, I've acted out of my confusion about self here, you know, wanting to bring about certain ends and this sort of thing, getting angry or whatever. Let me just drop this now. Because my intention now for this moment in reciting these, I want to recite these with a pure mind where I'm not in my personal mind here. I'm not doing this for gain or for anything else. So it's a way of kind of purifying your mind, deliberately to look at your own mind, not to judge it or to condemn it or to praise it or anything. And so that's why we have that before we then recite the precepts. Yeah. And it also doesn't mean that any of us can carry this out perfectly. You know, who can? I mean, I can't. But that's not the point. The point is, this is your intent, your will. Now, this is the kind of this is the will of a Buddha. We say the Buddha is without will, but a Buddha, their will, their intent is to be awake. And so, in effect, they were saying, with a pure heart, you know, if you really mean this. But even if you, you know, maybe that you feel like, well, I think there's some taint. Don't. If your desire is to speak and act out of a pure heart and mind, this is all we're expressing here. But first, we can kind of admit that I haven't always done this, but now, in this moment, I want to make this effort. This is what I want to do. Even if I can't really carry it out perfectly, this is what I want to do. And so that's what the formless admission is all about. It's not about guilt and laying blame or anything like that. Sometimes it's called formless repentance, but that's how it gets translated into English. That's not really the right word. Because now it's saying, well, I've done these bad things. Well, we're not even saying this stuff is bad, but it is willed. And we're letting it go. You know, so at least we're making them as best an effort as we can. Okay, well, we have gone over the hour, so I better stop. Was there another question? I thought I saw a hand. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.